Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Shut Up and Teach podcast. I'm your host, Elijah Carbajal. As a teacher, I know how important it is to stay informed and inspired, and that's one reason why I started this podcast. On the Shut Up and Teach podcast, we have honest conversations and purposeful reflections on all things educational, with the goal of inspiring you to take action in your classroom. Whether you're a new teacher just starting out or you're a seasoned pro, we've got you covered. If it's educational related, we're going to talk about it. So be sure to hit that like and subscribe button so that you can stay updated when new content is released. Now, it's time to shut up and teach.
This podcast is a proud member of the Teach Better Podcast Network. Better today, better tomorrow, and the podcast to get you there. Explore more podcasts at www.teachbetterpodcastnetwork.com. Now let's get on to the episode.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of the Shut Up and Teach podcast. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm sure that your time listening to this podcast is going to be very well spent and that you're going to really enjoy this conversation. Today on this episode, I spoke with Eric Francis. Eric Francis, M.E.D. and M.S., is an international author, educator, presenter, and professional development provider with over 25 years of educational experience. Eric is the author of several books, one being Now That's a Good Question, How to Promote Cognitive Rigor Through Classroom Questioning. He is also the author of Deconstructing Depth of Knowledge, a method and model for deeper teaching and learning. He also has a third book that is scheduled to be released this coming April. It will be called Inquiring Minds Want to Learn, Posing Good Questions to Promote Student Inquiry. Eric is also the owner of Maverick Education, which provides professional development guidance and support on how to plan and provide teaching and learning experiences that are standards-based, social and emotionally supportive, and student-responsive. Eric has also been consistently ranked as one of the world's top 30 educational professionals by the international research organization Global Gurus and the top 25 thought leaders. On this episode, Eric and I spoke at length for what professional development should actually look like at a school so that it's not merely a presentation, merely a sit and get. Eric really has an idea for how we can reshape what professional development looks like. We also discussed at length depth of knowledge. What does depth of knowledge actually mean and what does it look like to implement those in the classroom? I know this is going to be an episode that you're going to enjoy, so sit back, relax, and let's get to our conversation with Eric Francis. All right, everybody, welcome to the Shut Up and Teach podcast, and welcome, Eric Francis. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm great, Elijah. Thanks for having me on today. I really appreciate this opportunity.
Great. Yeah, I'm so excited that we can make this happen. We're going to have a fantastic conversation today talking about DOKs. That's, you know, obviously your book. Now, that's a great question. That's what it's all centered around. But before we get into that, I wonder if you could give our listeners a little bit of your educational evolution and what that kind of looks like.
Well, I would even say that the education evolution was not a was an unpredictable path in that case. Teaching was not my first career. I actually worked in the film industry before I became a teacher, worked for a producer and a big name producer, and I just hated it. It was just not a great experience. So I became a teacher in 95 and I was a classroom teacher. I taught middle school and high school English. And then I went on to become a site administrator. And then I worked for the State Department of Education here in Arizona. That's where I am, in Scottsdale, Arizona. And then 2012, I kept on having people say to me, you should go and consult, you should go and consult. And I'm like, I don't know. I was kind of, you know, liking the security of my job, you know, paycheck every 2 weeks, you know, health insurance for my family. So then I took the leap in about January 2012 and formed my company, Maverick Education. It's no C in Maverick. It's named after my daughters, Madison, Avery, and Amanda, and my name, E-R-I-K. And yeah, I just went from there from being a Title I consultant. So I would help schools set up their Title I programs and do their compliance, which is what I did at the State Department, that and English language learners. And then I just started writing books, and I wrote my first book, Now That's a Good Question, 2016, and came known more as the questioning guy with that. And then I really became very, very drawn into this concept of depth of knowledge, DOK, not only just because of what the concept was, but also there's so much misinformation, misinterpretation of what exactly it is and how we can use it. So, and that's how I kind of led to whoever I am right now, you know, this author, you know, professional development provider. And it was not a pathway. It was not even an idea. It was not a dream or a goal, which is kind of funny because that's what it's become today. Like I have a lot of people say, oh, I want to, you know, write a book and provide professional development and go and do. And to me, this was not anything that was even an option or an opportunity. It just kind of fell in my lap. And I think that's also a little bit why I've been able to do what I've been doing as long as I have, because it wasn't this ideal. It wasn't this aspiration. It was like, huh, here's this interesting thing. Well, let's see where we go with this. And it's become a great thing. And I'm very grateful for the opportunity that after I've been doing this now, next year will be 13 years. And I'm just grateful for the opportunity that people still find me helpful and the strategies, the methods, the message and mindset I come out there relevant. So,
and that's important, you know, for teachers to give you that feedback of this is relevant. How many times have you sat in a PD as a teacher and just been like, this has no relevancy to what we're doing, or, you know, to any, you know, to best practices or anything like that? So that's incredible feedback, in my opinion. I think that's great feedback to get.
It is. But, you know, I'll admit, I get the pushback on it because, you know, my PD is about making change, and making change is hard. It's not just hard in terms of the implementation. It's hard personally. It's basically the danger sometimes with PD is that you come in and you say, you know, here's a way, but your audience will interpret it like, well, wait a minute, why is that the way? You know, I'm fine. Thank you very much. I don't need you to come in and tell me this, that, and the other thing. And, you know, I hope even like in our conversations today, because, you know, I would love to give the perspective of the PD presenter about what comes in, because a lot of time it's a catch-22 situation. You know, we come in, we have, you know, if we're lucky, we can have a day, but a lot of times it's 2 hours. Okay. Mm-hmm. So you think of it this way, and I feel for the teachers because, you know, what if you were expected to learn this concept, a brand new concept and a process from this teacher you have no relationship with, the teacher you have no idea who they are. You not only have to learn this in 2 hours, but you have to be masters. You have to have mastery of it in 2 hours. And you're taught by a teacher who you're probably never, ever going to see again. You know, we wouldn't do that to our kids. So why do we do that to our teachers? And why do we think that, you know, that's effective professional development? So I feel for the teachers. I get it. And I got to tell you, as a PD person, it's like, I want you to come in there to have such a bang for your buck. And I want you to walk away at least with something. But I can tell you, like, one of the hardest challenges I have as a PD presenter is that I got to figure out how I connect with that teacher, because there's a lot of things they're bringing into that PD. And I have to be socially, emotionally sensitive and social, emotionally aware to what that teacher is feeling. I mean, they could be coming in there and they're forced to do this PD, or they could be coming in there and, man, they're having the worst day. You know, they got a speeding ticket in the morning, or, you know, they got in a fight with their significant other or family member. Or, you know, maybe I remind them of something. I mean, there's triggers that, you know, we don't even realize that we put into each other. There's a great book. It's an Oprah book, actually. It's called Whatever Happened to You. And that really transformed the way I look at audiences. There's a part in it where they talk about a student who was unruly and disruptive in elementary school in every class. And so what do you do in elementary when you have a male student that is disruptive? You put him with a male teacher. You know, mm-hmm. Let's see if he works better with a male. Mm-hmm. Well, it got worse And the reason why it got worse was because the male teacher's aftershave, this is a story in the book, the male teacher's aftershave was similar to the relative who is sexually abusing him. So now they found the core, the why. So that's why a lot of times when I try to look at, you know, the way teachers behave, because sometimes the behavior's not the greatest, Elijah, I'll tell you. I mean, sometimes, you know, I sometimes get, you know, hecklers, rabble rousers, people push back. This is not relevant for me. But I got to figure out how I tap into that. What can I do to trigger that thing that makes it worthwhile for them? And I have to also be sensitive, because again, I may remind them of somebody that they don't like in their life, or I have to be sensitive to the fact, what are they bringing into the room? My mom, Julie Francis, actually taught me that. She said, put yourself in the shoes of the other person. And that's what I do. And that's the thing about, hopefully, you know, why my PD is, you know, seem to be effective. But you know, Elijah, I get people that it's not their cup of tea. You know, I get, you know, this is the worst PD I ever sat with. Da, 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 da. Okay. It's like, great. You had to put that out there. Thank you. You know, you hurt my feelings. I appreciate, you say something and, you know, you say, hey, I can walk on water, and somebody puts on their thing, you know, well, he can't swim, you know, so that's why he walks on water. So, you know, it's a delicate line. You know, you're not going to get everybody, but at least try. You got to try to do that. But it's hard in the amount of time we have, you know, 2-hour PD. That's not effective. I mean, it's that, and that's why I say schools, even I say, you know, when I say, we want you to come in, and I say, well, do you want the rock show or the relationship? And they go, what's the rock show? I said, you know, 2 hours, I'll play my greatest hits. You know, I will edutain your audience. They will walk away with an experience, but a relationship means I teach them, I come back. We, you know, I have a thing on my website where I offer schools after I come in for a PD that you can text me through a chat bot. You can schedule time with me on a Calendly to have a one-on-one Zoom, or I'll plan with you, but it's hard. I mean, and I think going forward, we really need to look at how we're delivering PD and how we're taking it and how we're responding to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's the big thing, is like the follow-up, right? Mm-hmm. Because, so I haven't done a lot of PD, you know, but I've done a little bit here and there in the district centered around a place they love. And mm-hmm. The first school, shout out Alamosa Elementary, right? They were the first school in my district to pick up the book and be like, we're going to do a book study. Mm-hmm. They called me in for PD, so I, you know, delivered that. But then I threw it out there like, you know what? Like, would you be down if I followed up? Because I really wanted to know, was the PD effective? Was the book effective? What was the actual result? I want to hear from them. And, but I appreciate also what you're saying about, you're not going to be everybody's cup of tea, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, one thing that I've just learned to kind of say when I get some pushback, or, you know, things, you know, people who don't like the book or whatever, is, just, well, somebody has to have that opinion of me. So that's okay mm-hmm. if it's you, you know?
Yeah. And it's like when you're a teacher, you know, I was never the most well-loved 100% teacher. You know, when I taught high school, I wasn't the one that, you know, all the kids picked, you know, to be on, I forgot what that line's called, when you get it and then you walk down and they can run up and hug their favorite teachers or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I was a respected teacher. You know, you knew you were going to learn from me. And, you know, it's about creating a relationship. You know, in 2 hours, you're not going to love what I do, especially when I come in and say, hey, here's this thing, da 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 da, and we need to really focus on this. And teacher's like, why? I'm fine. You know, or I've been doing this for this many years. Why do I need to change now? Or this is my job. I don't, you know, and it's not everybody, but you have to look at those elements in there. To me, I look at the teachers who are like that in the PD, like the kids I wasn't reaching in my class. You know, there's not really a difference between, well, the only difference between really PD with adult teachers and teaching students is the age, you know, and also the leverage, because, you know, I can do things with students if they're disruptive or, you know, there's a disciplinary issue. You can't do that to teachers. You can't give them the cock of the eyebrow or the raise of the eyebrow. And because, you know, that won't, the teacher will go, what are you looking at? Right. You know, or, you know, I can't send them to the office. Though I did do that once, actually. I had it where this teacher was just so disruptive. And you know, and I try to do it in a way that's funny and logical. And I try to put it where, like, you know, to make you reflect. So I'd say, you know, so how would you feel? What would you do if a student was acting towards you like the way you're acting right now in this professional development? And this one teacher said, I wouldn't put up with it. I just sent him right to the office. And I said, well, that's where I'd like you to go for the rest of this PD. I'd like you to go to the office, please. And they looked at me. And luckily, I had the principal back me up and said, let's go. And sat them down there in the in-school suspension room until the end of the day. And I felt horrible. I'm like, that's not what I wanted, you know? But I appreciate, you know, the support. So the teacher, so the principal brings me in with his teacher and, you know, you, and they're saying, you know, you're representing your school. Do you realize, you know, your behavior is there and you're a representative of us? You know, do you know how much it costs to bring Mr. Francis here? And I'm like, oh, no. And they go, Mr. Francis, you know, you want to say it to this teacher? And I said, yeah. I said, what was it that you didn't connect with? What was it that you didn't like? Mm. What was it about me that set you off? You know, a lot of times you find out it's a larger issue. It's a larger story. It's a personality conflict. And, you know, I'll admit, I have sometimes administrators who say to me, okay, Eric, you know, we won't let that teacher come back. That's fine. You know? And I'm like, nah, bring him in. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, and it's there's a thing called the law of diffusion innovation. That person is on the other side of it, where it's like what they call late adapters or laggers, for lack of a better word, where they refuse to, you know, embrace the technology. Like the law of diffusion innovation is like a bell curve. So you got, you know, the far left side of it. That's the ones who want to be first. Those are the ones who are like, they sleep outside of Apple because they want to get the first new iPhone, or they sleep out in Star Wars movies because they want to be the first showing. And then you have what we call the innovators. They love new things. And then you have the early adopters who are saying, okay, this looks interesting. I think I'll buy into it. The late adopters are, okay, I see how this is working. Yeah, I think I'll go into it. And then you got the laggers, and the laggers are the ones who are like, well, you know what? I got to go give up my rotary phone because everyone now has a smartphone. You know, they finally succumb and get in. It's like those people like, well, cable is the way. So I guess now I'm not going to just look at air channels. I look at that person. That person is that teacher I gotta connect with, and I gotta figure it out. And that's the thing, because, you know, when you're a professional development provider, you don't really leave teaching. You just left the classroom. You're dealing with different behaviors, and the behaviors are much more dynamic than when you have it with kids, because I mean, you've done professional development, doing PD with adults, where they're coming in, they have a set mindset, they have all this experience and expertise behind them, and you're trying to show them or help them. And there's barriers there. And what can I do? So I look at that like that's my kid in my classroom who was the most resistant to my teaching. What can I do? How do I connect with that person? You know, and if you don't, then you just kind of got to go, you know, it's beyond you. It might be something bigger beyond you that deals with that person, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Just one more thing, and then we'll get into our sure. conversation about depth of knowledge. But there was somebody who had made a comment about my book, and basically they were saying, like, this guy's a nobody. Like, I don't know who this person is. And to me, I was like, that's super honest, and I actually appreciate that because I don't want anybody to just be like, oh, that's Elijah Carbajal, and for me to just expect, right? And it's like, yeah, you don't know who I am. So, like, let's connect. Let's have a conversation, right? Let's build that relationship, like you're saying, like you're talking about, before we, you know, just throw it on and just be barf it out and be like, this is the way, right?
But that's the thing, and I want to pedal back on that you are somebody. You wrote this book. You have this idea. You're bringing some sort of everyone brings some sort of value to the table, you know? And it's really funny you say that, because I have some, I know people who they do the professional development, they do this, and they'll say, well, no one really takes me seriously because I haven't written a book. And I'm like, so what? You know, or I'm not at that level. There's no level. There's no caste system in what we do. You wrote a book. Fantastic. Somebody said your ideas were valuable enough to capture into print. And that thing right there, you're not your book, but you are Elijah Carbajal. Okay. And that's your why is why you have, why you're special out there. You're not out there self-serving. Trust me. You're probably not out there. He's like, because I love doing this. You're doing this because I'm trying to help. I'm trying to give. I have a belief. I have a cause. I have a purpose. I am trying to share. For someone to say that to you, and hopefully no one said that, that, you know, they totally don't get it. They totally don't get it. And it's really interesting because there's some things I look at when people will say, Eric, I want to do what, you know, this professional development, writing books you do. I'll ask them why. And if they say, well, I'll make more money, stop. Mm-mm. Or, well, I think teachers need da, 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 stop. That's not why you do this. And Elijah, I mean, I'll be dynamic with it. I think we even need to look at what we mean by professional development and support, because it's all getting lumped in. And what we all need to recognize, not only just us as educators, but also as an education system, a keynote and a convocation is not professional development. Mm-hmm. Okay. It is not professional learning. Okay. It is more of a thing that has not an educational. I get it for the social emotional aspect of it. And, you know, I've keynoted. I mean, I'll admit, I'm not crazy about keynoting because I'm more concerned, are you laughing with me than learning from me? You know, am I edutaining you rather than educating you? Give me a workshop over a keynote any single day. But I think that's the thing, and that's the hard part. And I think as those of us who do this work need to realize there's a difference between when you're keynoting and you're providing professional learning and professional guidance. You know, it's basically, and the hard part also is this, Elijah, and I'll go out and boldly say it, is that when you're keynoting and you're coming in and you do it and you have this amount of time and you're charging a certain amount of money, you may be damaging the professional learning that's continuous for the year, because we have limited budgets for professional development. And a lot of it comes from here in the States, we call it Title II, our federal funding for professional development. And that's usually not a lot of money. That's a lot. Usually, if we're lucky, it could be low to mid five figures. But but that's supposed to be your professional development for the year. But when you're charging that same amount for a 1 hour keynote and the school can't work with you for the rest of the year, or someone else, that's a problem. Mm-hmm. Okay. Because I'll tell you right now, you may have had a great message and you may have a great message and you may do great things. And in that hour, you may have given such a great thing, or in that one day, you may have given such a great thing, but how do you sustain it? Everyone I've talked to right now who had it, has brought in somebody with a convocation or a keynote and spent big money. Okay. I talked to him in October. I said, how are things going? And they go, oh, and they talk about how. I said, well, you had so-and-so come in the beginning. How, you know, is the message still there? And they said, well, no, it was great. Everyone walked out feeling great. And then school started and the message went away. And I said, well, what are you doing to bring him back? And they said, I can't afford to bring him back. Mm-hmm. That's a problem. Yeah, that's a problem, you know? And are we pricing ourselves out on this? Are, you know, there's a lot of money, as we both know, to do this, but it's not about the money. It's about the relationship. That's the reward. It's about, you know, what can you set up so you can come back? And some people say, well, I'm going to go get paid what I'm worth. Yeah, I'm worth a lot, but guess what? There's people who can't afford me. So what can I do? And that's the funny thing, because when I talk about PD with a school district, they'll say, well, how much is it? And I say, well, I'm going to give you a price, but that's the start of a conversation, not the end of it, because I want that relationship. I'm always saying, well, what's the next steps? What are we going to do? Well, we're not really sure. Oh, great. So you just brought me in for a one and done. And I hate that. You know, I want to have a relationship with that. That's the big thing. So I hope you don't mind if I went off into that, but I think we need to really look at how we're doing PD. And I really think that if we start doing this and we start looking at it from a cost-effective, a time-effective, and a human resources-effective manner, PD will get better. Because I'm going to tell you right now, and we'll repeat, the teachers, they were like, yeah, it was great to hear that for an hour, but you know, I was enlightened, but I'm not taking it with me, you know, or, okay, here's this person. There's people even come in and say, oh, Eric's just here to sell books. Really? If I'm here to sell books, I would have like forced you all to buy one. I mean, and even in conferences, they'll go, oh, you can't sell your book. I said, I'm not selling my book. I'm sharing my ideas. So, right. Yeah.
Right. It's the message, right? It's the message, right. The idea behind it. Exactly. Exactly.
Right.
Awesome. Well, this has already been such a great conversation. I'm glad you had that, because that's been something, I know that's a conversation that Tracy and I have had multiple times when it comes to quality PD and like you're saying the follow-up and all that. So that's great. You're sharing some great things there. I hope some people are, you know, taking that to heart. I certainly am. Okay. So let's get into our conversation now about depth of knowledge, right? DOKs. Mm-hmm. In a nutshell, right, maybe for new teachers, maybe it's a new concept, new idea for some teachers or schools, people listening today. Mm-hmm. In a nutshell, what is depth of knowledge, the DOKs?
So depth of knowledge is a different and deeper way of looking at what we call the cognitive demand of your academic standards, your curricular activities, and your assessment items. It's not about the level or type of cognition or thinking kids have to learn. And it's not even about the difficulty of the content or the complexity of the content students must learn. It's about what exactly students must think about and learn, and how deeply must they understand and use their thinking or their knowledge or their learning. So what depth of knowledge is about is that it actually makes the learning more concrete and visible. You know, for the last 60 years, we've been living in by Benjamin Bloom and Bloom's taxonomy. And there's nothing wrong with that. I'm not saying throw out the baby with the bathwater. I'm saying that we need to clarify what exactly students must learn and how deeply students must understand, use their learning. The problem with cognitive action verbs, I'm going to call them cognitive action verbs, not just verbs, is that they're very abstract and have multiple meanings. I mean, how many times you look at a Bloom's taxonomy and you look at the level and there's like 50, 60 verbs listed on that level. So if the standard says understand, well, what exactly am I doing with understanding? And what people don't realize about Bloom's taxonomy as well is that all the levels beyond remember are different levels of understanding. You have base and then you have deeper going all the way up to create. When Norman Webb created DOK, he created it not even as a method of model for teaching and learning. It was a criterion for alignment studies. You would look at your standards. You would look at your activities and assessments. You would code them as a 1, 2, 3, or 4. And then you would see how closely they are aligned to each other. And Karen Hess took it to the next level. She made it a measure for cognitive rigor. So she made the Hess matrix. So you look at Bloom's, that's the level of thinking. You look at depth of knowledge, that's the context in which you would understand, use your learning. Both together is a measure of cognitive rigor. So if the verb was analyze, and I'm analyzing whether the information is in the text, that's a DOK one, because how do I show that I'm doing that? Okay, so what's the question you would ask? Well, is the information is in the text? Yes. Boom. That's DOK one. Mm-hmm. But if I said analyze how the information supports the central idea and theme in a text, now I'm still analyzing, but what exactly am I analyzing? The information and central idea and theme. How deeply, how it supports the central idea and theme in a text. Now I have to justify or verify with evidence. Now I'm at a DOK three. So I'm still at a Bloom's 4, which is what analyzes the level, but now I'm at a DOK 3. So she made a measure for cognitive rigor. I took it because everybody tried using it as a method model for teaching and learning. And I said, okay, well, how can it become a method model for teaching and learning? So I turned it into a multi-tiered system of support. So with depth of knowledge, you code the DOK level of the standard. That is what Karen Hess calls the ceiling of assessment. So if I know my standards are DOK 3, here's what I know. The assessments will not assess beyond that ceiling because that's unfair. And the only assessment that will do that, that's a standardized assessment, are math assessments. Because most math standards are DOK-1s and DOK-2s. But because you have those standards of mathematical practice, that's what makes it the deeper DOK level. So that is the ceiling of assessment. So when I look at that standard, it says it's a DOK-3. That's the deepest level the kids could and should be assessed. Mm-hmm. They also won't be assessed at that, only at that level, because that makes it too difficult. Assessment is used to determine where you are in your learning. So you'll be assessed to that DOK 3 level. So items will make, there'll be some DOK 1s, there'll be some DOK 2s and DOK 3s. So the way I turn into the method model for teaching and learning is that teaching and testing, and I want to make sure I'm saying testing, starts and stops with the standard. But teaching and learning begins where the students are and builds on their strengths so they can rise to reach and go beyond the bar. Mm-hmm. So when I talk about how we use depth of knowledge, I say it's a method and model for delivering instruction. So the teacher's always like, here's the standard. Can you reach it? No. Can you do this? No. Can you do it this level? No. Can you do it this level? Yes. Okay, good. Let's start there. Mm-hmm. That's what also makes it respond to intervention because mm-hmm. you're trying to figure out where they are in their learning. But you also want to possibly take the kids beyond the standard. So that's enrichment or extension, as we talk about in the gifted world. But lately, I've been talking about how DOK can be used to address and assess what we put in quotes, learning loss. Mm. So that's what I did with DOK. I turned it into a method and model of teaching and learning. So the thing is that if everyone walks away from this thing today, DOK is not about the verb. It's about what comes after that cognitive action in that objective. And I also say DOK, the rigors in the response. If all I have to do is attain the answer, it's a DOK 1. If I have to explain the answer, it's a DOK 2. And I have to give you examples. Mm-hmm. If I have to justify or verify with evidence, it's a DOK 3. And if I have to explore or extend, it's a DOK 4. So Elijah, you're a literacy person, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So if I'm basically doing just reading the book fluently, and I'm doing basic, reading foundational skills. I can tell you what the book's about. I can tell you all the literary elements in it. That's a DOK 1. Mm-hmm. If I explain how the literary elements work together or how the author uses craft and structure, I'm using examples from the book. That's a DOK 2. If I'm using facts and feelings as evidence, if I'm saying, how does the book address this theme or how does it address this central idea with evidence from the text, that's a DOK 3. If I'm reading more than one text and doing that in an author study or a genre study or saying, this is how literary fiction represents this idea and this is how literary nonfiction represents this idea and doing a comparison, that's a DOK 4. So it's about the experience. It's about what exactly must students learn and how deeply must they understand, use their learning and the rigors in the response.
Awesome. I you spawned a question there for those who are listening and not watching the episode here. You said learning loss with quotation marks there. Mm-hmm. Could you address that? What do you mean by that there in quotation marks there?
Learning loss is real. But lately, it's become an advertising slogan that people can stand in a pulpit and say, there are learning loss. You know what they used to be? It used to be, our students need college and career readiness, but no one can really quantify what it is. Mm. You know, it's really funny. I say this. It's funny because people look at me because I say, do you know why we say learning loss? And do you know why we say college and career readiness? Because it sounds sexy. You know, it's like advertising. You know, and another comparison I have is that if I say post-secondary readiness, which is what the actual concept of college and career readiness is, in fact, that's half the pie. People go, huh, what? But if I say college and career readiness, people get it. If I say gaps in learning, people go, huh, what? But if I say learning loss, oh, I can get that. I like to compare it to like, you ever seen Jaws?
Yes.
Okay, remember the part where in the beginning the mayor says to Brody, Martin, it's simple. You say barracuda, people go, huh, what? You say shark, we have a problem on the 4th of July. That's what learning loss is. So learning loss is not a pandemic thing. That's why I put it in quotes. Learning loss is inherent in education. And there's actually a thing I do in my PD to understand why we teach and learn for DOK or why they're getting this PD is I have them go, and first I have them go look up what the definition of learning loss is. And they have to read it verbatim to me from the source. And they read it verbatim. And then I go, okay, now in your own words, what does that mean? That's what takes it from a DOK 1 to a DOK 2. I can read fluently, but can I summarize it in my own words? That's a DOK 2. That's where you go to a deeper DOK level. But then I do a thing where I say, what causes learning loss? And they have to go find facts as examples, and they have to express their feelings and share their emotions. So what they find is if you go and look, it's not just the pandemic that caused learning loss. There's a great source called the Education the Glossary of Education Reform that talks about how summer vacation causes learning loss. Talks about how block scheduling can cause learning loss, talks about how ineffective teaching can cause learning loss. Now, this is a credible source of information. But what if I said that? I said, you know what causes learning loss? Bad teaching. You know what causes learning loss? Bad scheduling. You know what causes learning loss? Summer vacation. Now I got some charged up emotions there. See? Mm-hmm. So learning loss is inherent in education. And I don't know if we've really addressed that effectively to the standpoint that we could or should. And I think that's also the beautiful thing of the pandemic, because it should allow us to sit back and say, are we doing this effectively? Are we doing this in a manner that's not only effective, but also efficient? So if there's learning loss, and learning loss is not just a pandemic thing, bad scheduling can cause learning loss. I couldn't take that class. Now I need to take this class. I couldn't take it with that teacher. Now I take it this teacher. Bad teaching. You know, I had not a highly effective teacher, or I had a teacher who was a substitute for the year and did not have the material, did not give it to me. That can cause learning loss. I also talk about how bad times causes learning loss. And I even give a personal story, like, and I ask, when was your learning loss? I said, my learning loss happened in third and fourth grade because my parents got divorced. And you think I wanted to care about multiplication or fractions? My world was falling apart. I still struggle with those concepts years later. I did that on purpose. And, you know, or, you know, middle school was my learning loss because I did not connect with my teachers. I had actually some pretty cruel teachers. I had a math teacher told me I didn't have a head for math, so I better figure out what else I better do with my life. I had a science teacher who I finished the test and he ripped up, you know, the comic book I was reading, Legion of Superheroes, number 315. He ripped it up right in my face and told me time to grow up. You think I connected with that teacher? And that's the other thing. Think about it. I'm 53 years old and I'm still talking about what happened to me in sixth and eighth grade to this very day. So that's something we need to think about as teachers, like what you did Tuesday, that person can take for the rest of their life. So how are we addressing learning loss? So one of my ways to do it is I say that if we took a mindset that when the kids come to us, no one's at grade level. And some people go, yeah, they're not. Or some people go, well, some kids are above. I go, well, wait a minute. So Elijah, what grade are you? You're teaching a grade right now, right? Or are you? You're a reading specialist, right?
Yeah, reading intervention. So I teach currently first, second, and fourth.
Okay, so let's
grade they work with.
Right. So let's talk about the fourth graders you have. Were they fourth graders last year?
No.
Then they're not at grade level. See what I mean? They're going into fourth grade, but they're not at grade level. Mm-hmm. They're last year's grade level, or they're wherever they stopped. Mm-hmm. But they're not at grade level. What does grade level mean? The academic standard. That's what it means to demonstrate proficiency. So I need to start with the standard. This is the finish line. This is what it means to demonstrate proficiency in key details and ideas, talking about theme in fourth grade. Now, where are you on that pathway to proficiency? Okay, can you tell me what the theme of this story is? No. Well, do you know what a theme is? No. Do you know what the story is about? Yeah. Okay, let's start there.
Right.
Okay, so now what is the basic idea behind that story? Blah, 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 blah. Okay, how is that the theme? See? So now I'm building it back to the standard. So if we really want to address learning loss and we want to do it effectively, this is my, I'm going to quote a Peloton instructor. I make suggestions, you make decisions. If we really want to address learning loss, start with the standard. Say, guys, this is the finish line. This is what you all have to reach and cross. That's what it means to be standards-based. I believe you will all get there. That's what it means to be socially emotionally supportive. You may not get there in my time frame. You may not get there according to the curriculum map. You may not even get there by the time the assessment comes, but you will get there. I believe it. And I will do everything possible to make sure you get there. But I need to know what you need to get there. That's what it means to be student responsive. So that's what I mean by learning loss. That's what I mean by we all just have to go in. No one's at grade level. What is grade level? That's standard. You don't got to like it, but it's what you, you know, it is what you make it. That's the finish line. Get them to it, get them through it, and then get them beyond it. And that's, I really think, is what's going to really address learning loss, is that start with the standard, tier to where the kids are, find their strengths, and build on their strengths so they can rise to reach and go beyond that bar.
Yeah, exactly. So where do you start as far as where would you, or where would you suggest if someone were coming to you, hey, Eric, I'm loving what you're saying here. You know, I have the standards, like I know where the finish line is. I need to figure out where my kids are at in, you know, on the track to that finish line. I kind of need to figure out where they're at. Where do I start with that?
You start with the standard. You have to, and I'm not going to say unwrap and unpack the standard. That was a No Child Left Behind method, okay? Mm-hmm. Because those standards lent themselves, great way for Larry Ainsworth came up with. You know, I'm never going to bash what someone else came up with and say, I could do it better. I don't do that, okay? Larry Ainsworth came up with a great way that he says, look for key concepts and skills. The problem is that a lot of times when you do professional development, things get watered down and get misinterpreted. Like how many times have you heard that people say, Danielson has said, we're not doing her framework effectively, you know, or we have this thing, essential questions, and Jay McTighe and Grant Wiggins say essential questions are this. And then all of a sudden we got factual questions as essential questions. No, use that. You need to basically what I call deconstruct the standard. So you do the Ainsworth method. You circle your cognitive actions. I'm not saying verbs, because a lot of times people see a verb and go, oh, that's what the kids have to do. No. Okay. What's the cognitive action? Then you underline all the content words. Okay. So let's say I said the standard is determine a theme from the story from details in the text. We'll just keep it at that. Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm circling determine and I'm underlining theme, story, details, text. Okay. Then what you do is you take a highlighter and you highlight everything that comes after determine and stop when you hit a period or a semicolon. Okay. Mm-hmm. Everything in that yellow, that's what you look at for depth of knowledge. The underlined words are the foundation. That's your academic vocabulary and terminology the kids have to know and understand. So determine a theme of a story from details in the text. They have to know what a theme is. They have to know what the story is, and they have to know what the text is. So can you do that? No. Well, do you know what theme means? No. Well, do you know what the story is that you're reading in this text that you're reading? Yeah. Okay, good. Let's start there. Mm-hmm. Then what you do, and this is something because some people get confused with when I say what comes after the verb. I tell people, put a box around everything you have not underlined in that highlighted area. So again, if I say determine a theme of a story from details in the text, I am putting a box around A. I am putting about box around, again, A of a story. I'm putting a box around from the. That A and those boxed words is what determines the DOK level. And what, so because if I said determine the theme of a story from details in the text, how many themes am I looking for? One. Mm-hmm. But now it's saying determine a theme. That means, there's more than one. And what people need to know is this is how they're changing the standards right now. Everybody's standards are changing. It's been 10 years since we adopted Common Core or College and Career Readiness. The kids have changed. So with that, the standards have to change. The difference is they're not doing what the Common Core did. Let's throw the baby out with the bathwater. Boom, here's these whole new standards. They're tweaking them. They're changing the standard algorithm to a standard algorithm. Mm-hmm. Oh, more than one. They're changing determine the story from details in a text, which could be a DOK 2 because you have to explain what the theme is from details in a text, maybe a DOK 3 to explicitly saying determine a theme of a story and explain how the details in the text support it. Now I know that's a DOK 3 because mm-hmm. it's evidence. The science teachers are having a devil of a time with the next generation science standards because the standards used to be what we call core concept standards. So they would say, explain the function of the cell and the way the parts contribute to the function. I can teach that and I can do this lab and I can do. Now it says, develop and use a scientific model to explain the fun. Now the science teachers are like, well, wait a minute, because now it's not giving them science activities. Now the kids have to understand, use their learning like a scientist would. Mm-hmm. So I have to have that student come up with not only their own model, that's just developing. Now they have to justify how they can use with that model, what the function of the cells is and the way the parts contribute to the function. So that's the important thing. And that's why I say it is important to look at DOK, because the rigor is in the response and it's also contextual. And because you see these expansion of the standards with these criteria, with these conditions, that's what makes it rigorous. And that's why we need to look at that. So you need to start with the standard and then build it back. So when I do my training, I say, okay, well, let's see what the kids have to do to get through the standard and just deconstruct it to get through the standard and create my tier one. My tier two is I may need to spend more time on that foundational knowledge to get them to tier one. My tier three would be, well, what are the fundamentals they lack or they don't have? Or where are they? And that's when I might have to go to even reduce DOK levels or reduce grade levels. But I'm always searching for their strengths. And I don't use RTI to say, you know, this kid's a tier one, this kid's a tier two, this kid's a tier three. I use it, and not as a diagnostic, to say, you know, I've done this a tier one, I've done this a tier two, I've done this a tier three. It's not working. Now it's time to go to a TAT or special education identification, or maybe it's English language learner. I do it where, like Mike Maddows and Austin Buffer made it, where it's an inverted RTI, where I'm taking it down to where the student needs it. I'm taking it to the individual child mm-hmm. and then finding that strength. Where did that gap occur? It might not have occurred during the pandemic. It might have occurred in second grade because their parents got divorced and they were having all these emotional things going on, or they had an illness, or they did not have the most effective teacher. Where did that learning stop? Mm-hmm. What is that strength level? And then, okay, you can do this. Now, this is how you used to do it, to do this. You do this. I'll tell you, I've seen it. You know, I've had schools where their scores have gone up because if you start with the standard, you centered everything around the standard, you tier to where they are, use your curriculum as your resource and tool, and use your instructional talent, find out where that student is, and then build them back to, through, and beyond the standard. So start mm-hmm. with the standard in the elevator speech that I would give you on that.
I love it. Love it. And that's a great example, or a great, you know, example of walking through those the MTSS process, right? The multi-tiered mm-hmm. systems of support there. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of nerd out on that a little bit. In New Mexico, we have to be different, so it's MLSS, the multi-layered mm-hmm. systems of support. But it's the same system, right? We go through, and and New Mexico is kind of late to the game on a lot of things. So it's just, you know, in some ways just barely being implemented across the state now. Where I'm at, we've been at it now for 3 years, so we're full implementation already. And we're seeing like tremendous results of going through, and like you said, what can they do? And so mm-hmm. that's sort of where we start, you know, as a reading interventionist, it's like, let's check foundational skills first. And
right.
And we just go through until we get to that, you know, what they might call the frustration level, right? Where they mm-hmm. start to, you know, they start misreading some words, or there's spelling patterns, right? Diagraphs, mm-hmm. right? Things like mm-hmm. that they may not recognize, mm-hmm. because then that gives me the exact place of where I need to start with those kids. And even to the point where I might say, oh, they know digraph CH, SH, TH, but they don't know WH and CK, right? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, I can pinpoint specifically, this is what we need to work on here. So yeah, great, great. Thank you for taking us through that.
You got it. You got it. You know, and that's amazing you say. So I would want to ask you, because you're a reading specialist. I've seen reading specialists that actually call out and say, this is a digraph to the students when they're working with them. I've seen reading interventions do it. And I've asked them, I said, you know, why do you even tell them what the term is? I know why. And I want to tell you right now, I think that's great practice. Okay. Because I'll bring that point up why. And they told me why. I said, well, if they don't understand what a digraph is, then they're not going to understand how to read it when they experience a digraph. And that's really an important thing. And it's funny to lead into that, because one of the things I'm telling people and teachers is I'm asking them to consider what is essential to learn, important to understand, and nice to know. And we probably have all heard those three questions before, but I put a little twist on it. A lot of times, essential to learn fits the real criteria. You know, it's, you know, readiness, it has endurance, it's going to be assessed, and it has leverage, meaning that I'll be using it in different places. Now, a lot of times what people say important to understand, nice to know, is that that's what the teacher wants to teach. I think that's a cop-out. I think that's a cop-out to the teachers to say, oh, that's what the teacher wants. Yeah, we want to teach things. But a lot of things that we want to teach is what I call nice to know, which means that it's extended. But important to understand, I say, is this important to understand so the student can demonstrate their learning or demonstrate what's essential to learn? So I'll give you an ELA example. I was working with a school district in Chicago, and we were working together, and the standard said, describe how the stories, how a story develops over the course of the text and moves towards a resolution. And so the teacher's like, oh my gosh, resolution. Now I got to teach them all, you know, the elements of a plot. You know, I go, stop, calm down. Okay. What are the elements of the plot? We listed out exposition, conflict, rising action, climax, falling action, resolution. Now, what I tell people is that if that term is in the standard, then that's essential to learn, because guess what? That's going to be on the test. Someone's going to say, mention resolution in the test. So then I broke it down. So I said, okay, let's talk about the elements of text. What's the first element? They said exposition. I said, is that essential to learn, important to understand, or nice to know? And they go, oh, it's essential to learn. And I go, why? He goes, because the exposition leads into the conflict. And I said, what? And they said, conflict. I go, so it's important to understand exposition to understand how it leads into the conflict, which is essential to learn. Because you're going to be talking about conflict a lot in every book, right? They go, yeah. I go, okay, what about rising action? Oh, that's kind of nice to know. What about climax? Yes, that's essential to learn, because everyone gets that confused and everyone thinks that's the end. It's actually the turning point. Okay, what about falling action? Oh, that's nice to know. Well, what about resolution? Well, yeah, that's essential. It's in the standard, Eric. I go, okay. So now I'm not telling you to sacrifice. I'm telling you shift your time. If the kids are having a hard time with conflict, how can knowing what the exposition is help them understand conflict? That's important to understand. Mm-hmm. Climax. How can we use climax to say this is the turning point? We're going to talk about that in resolution. And I said, because I didn't hear where you talked about denouement. And they go, what's denouement? I said, that's what happens after the resolution. How do I know that? Because it's nice to know, mm-hmm. You know, or even math. There's a thing I do with it where I say the standard says fluently multiply multi-digit numbers using a standard algorithm. I will show a math problem. 542 times 398 equals 215,716. I'm not a math genius. I have a calculator and a phone. But then I'll label it, because I'm an ELA person, and I believe, I mean, the Marzano method, that you build background knowledge through academic vocabulary terminology. If I don't know what it is and I can't explain it, do I really know it? So I'll label it. I'll label the 215,716 as a product. I'll label the two numbers that you're multiplying as factors, and I'll call the first number multiplicand, and I'll call the second number multiplier. And then I go, okay, what's essential to learn? And they said, everything that's in that standard. I go, good. Now look at the terminology. What's essential to learn, important to understand, nice to know? So the math teacher will say product. And I say, why? And they said, because product's the answer. And you always talk about product. And I said, well, what about factors? And they said, well, that's important to understand. Then I have science teachers who tell me, well, wait a minute. We talk about factoring in science. Really? So now that has leverage. So factors are important to understand. Then it's look at multiplicand and multiplier. And the teachers will go, oh, that's nice to know. I go, well, what if that would help me understand what it means to multiply? They go, what do you mean? I said, well, what if I said multiplying is repeat addition? The first number is the multiplicand. That tells me how much I have. The second number is the multiplier. That tells me how many times I have to add it to itself or group it to get my product. When I do that with kids, when I say, okay, your first number, that's called the multiplicand. What's it called? Multiplicand. What does that mean? That's my constant. My second number is my what? Multiplier. What's that mean? It means I have to, how many times I'm adding it to itself or grouping it to get your what? Product. I'm now talking like a mathematician. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you, when I work with kids on that, the language, the vocabulary, that is essential. And I tell this to K-3 teachers. The kids may know how to add, they may know how to subtract, multiply, and maybe even divide, but that they can't tell me what addition is. They can't tell me what subtraction is. What they can't tell me is multiplication, division. It's not only that they can't not may know to do it deeply, but it's gonna not, it's gonna help them if they can explain it when we get into deeper math concepts. Because if I know what division is, and division is parts of a whole, and when I'm dividing things into parts and doing comparisons of that, I can basically then understand the concept of fractions, decimals, percents, and ratio. Mm-hmm. That is huge. If I understand addition is certain language of putting together and not, and combining, not grouping, that's multiplication. And that's something I've had to clarify with some people. Combining is when I put them together. Grouping is when I organize them. I then will know if I understand that concept, I won't get thrown off when I see -3 + 5, because if I just think, oh, a subtraction is bigger number minus sign, little number. Now I see -3 + 5. Now I'm like, what? So that's why I always say language is important with that. And that's what we really need to ask as teachers. Is this essential to learn? Meaning that it has the real criteria. Is this important to understand? Which means, well, knowing this help the kids understand what's essential to learn? Or is this just nice to know because it's nice to know? It's interesting. And that's fine. That's great. But you're not sacrificing it. But you have to shift the amount of time you spend so the kids can get the essentials and understand the importance and get to the nice to knows once they basically have been able to do what they need to do.
That's awesome. Thanks so much, man. That was great. I appreciate it. And this conversation has been fantastic. And you know, it's been such a great time having you on the show here. Before we wrap up, I'm going to ask you the 3-part question, that I ask everybody on the show. So, Eric Francis, I wonder if you can share what you're listening to, what you are watching, and what you're reading.
Okay. What am I listening to? I am, and I'll combine this with even reading. I really have gone back to Simon Sinek's Why books. I listen to his podcast, The Optimist. I think it's called The Optimist. I really like this concept of why. I first, you know, discovered, I heard about it, but I really delved into it during the pandemic, and I'm finding myself go back because I really think we need to really look at and consider why we're doing what we're doing. And we need to consider what that why means. You know, if I say a why that's results oriented, that's not really a why, that's an outcome. Mm-hmm. If I say a why as a want, that's different. That's about me. The why has to be something that's purposeful. Not what I believe, but a belief. Not, you know, the reason why I'm doing it, but a cause. So like one of the things I say about my business is my why for my business is to ensure teaching and learning is standards-based, socially, emotionally supportive, and student responsive so that the experience is academic and affective for all. Now, affective is actually the part of learning that talks about our emotional responses to it. There's actually even a part of Bloom's taxonomy that's called the affective domain. So when I see all these things about Maslow before Bloom's. Well, how about Maslow with Bloom's? Because you have this thing called the affective domain. So how can I get that to not only be an educational, but also an emotional experience? So Simon Sinek, I'm really looking at, I'm really even tying that into my PDs a lot lately about with, you know, start with your standard as your why, your how is how you teach it, and then your what is what you're teaching. So that's what I'm listening to and reading. I'm also listening a lot. I always listen to Tom Shimmer's podcast. He hasn't produced one in a while, but I listen to that and I listen to you too. And there's a number of people out there I listen because I want to start my own podcast. So I'm trying to learn from others. Music. If it's Van Halen, I'm always listening to it. You know, Led Zeppelin. You probably can see if you guys are watching all those things. Those are actually little coffee placers there with the album covers of Van Halen and Led Zeppelin. Watching, you know what I watch a lot is I watch a lot of YouTube videos. Because to me, I'm always learning. Like, man, I learned about this thing. I saw this thing and I get these YouTube recommendations and I saw this thing and it was called hostile architecture. And I'm like, what is that? And it's an actual thing where they actually design things purposefully so people will not sit on it and lie on it. And it's a very big thing that they're doing for with the homeless situation. It's not kind, it's cruel. But like, for example, they'll put like a grated box over the subway grates. And on the grated box, it's curved so you can't lie on it. But if you do figure out how to lie on it, right there in the middle of your back, there's a part of it that juts up. And or like if you see something that looks like you can sit down on it, but you really can't sit down on it and it's uncomfortable to sit on it, that's called hostile architecture. So I'll find all these weird, random things on there. For TV shows, you know, my go-to always is Law and Order SVU. But, you know, I really haven't watched a lot of TV lately. I mean, I'm watching Monarch on Apple TV, which is an extension of the MonsterVerse with Godzilla and King Kong. Oh, here's a recommendation. I saw Godzilla Minus One last night. It's the new Godzilla movie. And I know I'm talking Godzilla, but I wanted you to really hear about what I'm saying here. That's probably the best movie I've seen all year as a drama. Really? As an action drama. And everyone's like, Godzilla? Because it's not about Godzilla. It's actually a character study. It takes place after World War II. And it's about this Japanese veteran who was a kamikaze pilot who was too afraid to sacrifice himself. And he had fear. And one time, in the beginning, he lands his plane at one of the outposts. And Godzilla, as a small lizard, attacks it. And it's this legendary creature. And they told him to get in the Zero and shoot him down. And he froze up and people died. So he lives with this on his conscience. So it's actually a story about how Japan dealt with the aftermath of the atomic bombs. And this individual who was shamed and had to find courage. The catalyst is that Godzilla attacks Ginza and he finds the courage to basically do what he needs to do by stopping Godzilla. It's not cheesy. It's actually a character driven drama. And I'm sitting there and it's over 2 hours and I'm sitting there going, oh my God, because Asian cinema is a lot like that. It's a lot of character driven, you know, a lot of faith based, a lot of moral code. And I'm like, this is not a Godzilla movie. You think of it this way, like the movie Jaws was not about the shark. It was about the individuals and how they respond to the shark. Mm-hmm. The shark is this catalyst. That's what Godzilla is. It's not that there's this wild scientific thing. It's that this creature comes out of the ocean and causes havoc. And the people have to come together. And they're all these Japanese World War II veterans who are still dealing with the outcomes of the war and how they're dealing with it that they lost. And they have this thing that gives them the courage that they felt like that was taken away from them. And this he's a kamikaze pilot and he goes to not fight, but stop. you know, from the destruction. Mm-hmm. And it's just, you're sitting there going, this is not a Godzilla film. This is, and I'm really hopeful that Toho Pictures, and it's Japanese, so it's subtitled, but I'm really hoping Toho Pictures goes in a different direction where it's not that these people are dressed up in costumes and doing these monster special effects. It's like taking these people and how are they responding to an experience? Mm. So I had to share that's what I watched, you know, yesterday. And I'm sitting there going, I'm actually walking out of there going, this could be a best foreign film nomination. You know, and people are like, Godzilla? Nice. And I'm like, yeah, no, you got to see it. And I have friends I see it. I text this morning. They're like, Eric, I saw it. Oh my God, this is not a Godzilla film. This is an Asian drama, a Japanese art pick that features Godzilla as a catalyst in it. So that's I guess, you know, what I'm watching. So
great. Thanks for the recommendations.
You got it.
That's awesome. All right, Eric. Well, thank you so much. This has been such an enjoyable time for myself. How can our listeners get in contact with you, find out more information about you, get your books, all that?
Mm-hmm. Well, you can go to Maverick, M-A-V-E-R-I-K, education.com. That's my webpage. Don't put a C in it. If you put a C in it, you'll go to India. Because someone took my webpage there. So it's Maverick, M-A-V-E-R-I-K, education.com. That's where you'll find my webpage. There's a chat bot there. You can text me, ask me questions. I have two books out right now. My first one's from ASCD. It's called Now That's a Good Question. And you can find that at ASCD.com. The Depth of Knowledge DLK book is called Deconstructing Depth of Knowledge. That is at solutiontree.com. In fact, the actual page is www.solutiontree.com/truedok. But I'll make an announcement now. My third book is coming out in April. Ooh. And it's called, Inquiring Minds Want to Learn, Posing Good Questions to Promote Student Inquiry. So now that good question was about what are the questions we can ask. This is about, I created this thing called the Inquiring Minds Framework. And it talks about what does it mean to have an inquiring mind? What does an inquiring mind want? Mm-hmm. And it talks about how to address and approach teaching learning with an inquiring mind. It's not using the question just to assess, it's using the question to activate and advance. And there's going to be even a chapter where I talk about deep inquiry, about how you can use ChatGPT and AI to come up with the good questions that you can ask your kids. And I put that in there because I really think that we need to figure out ChatGPT. Look, the kids are going to use it to cheat. My gosh, they used abacuses to cheat back in the day before we had technology. Okay. But how can we as teachers use the technology? And the whole message was like, don't make the same mistake we made with Google, because Google's a way of life. And when you tell people you can't Google it, well, you're basically telling them to run a race with your shoelaces tied, you know. ChatGPT is a way of life, and there's a lot of great things on there for teachers that teachers can do. You can make lesson plans on there. Mm-hmm. So, and one of the hard things I find when I do PD is getting the teachers to come up with questions. That takes a lot of critical and creative thinking. But now I taught them in the book, I say, you know, there's a way to do it with ChatGPT that will give them all the questions. And you're like, oh, wow, okay. And if the kids use ChatGPT to come up with the answers, here's my secret to catch them. Go, hey, this is a great answer. Can you tell me in your own words what you meant there? Okay, what did ChatGPT say?
Yeah.
Use DOK2 to see if basically the kids are using ChatGPT for your answers. Great answer. What do you mean by that? Clearly.
ChatGPT told me this. So
yeah, ChatGPT told me this. Great. I want to know what you say. Put in your own words. So use ChatGPT. Use DOK2 will basically catch the kids on ChatGPT.
Oh man, that's crazy. Yeah. All right, well, I love it. So coming out in April, you said, right?
Yep.
April 2024. All right, well, thank you, Eric. Again, such a great time with you. I appreciate it, and thanks for sharing your knowledge and wisdom and encouragement as well. Appreciate
thank it. You for having me. I mean, I've really enjoyed your show, and I'm really glad that you had me on here, so thanks for the conversation.
Of course. All right, listeners, thank you so much for joining Eric and myself today. I hope you enjoyed this conversation. Please go share it with a friend. Interact with us. Let us know what you thought of the episode, and we will see you on the next show.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Shut Up and Teach podcast. I hope that you'll check out previous episodes, and I hope that you'll share this with a friend or a colleague.